Open to Leviticus chapter 25. So far in Leviticus, in the last few chapters, we had some laws given regarding the feast days, you remember, after the Great Day of Atonement. Different feast days, special days of worship. We saw that odd little story in chapter 24 of the man that came out, the son of an Egyptian and mother was an Israelite, and he came and blasphemed God, and you can see the effect it had on those on the nation, and how they, how God defined the punishment for that. Remember, it wasn't just a random story. It was a story to illustrate how amazing God provides through all these feast days, and then just how evil any offensive comments made against such a God is. And it just puts sin in perspective for us again. Now we come straight back to the feast days kind of laws, very specialized feast days in chapter 25. And once again, we're reminded, it's the other bookend of that crazy story. It's the bookend again showing you just how extraordinarily blessed a people is whose God is Yahweh, the true God. And again, it helps us make sense of this young man that came and blasphemed the name and was immediately, well, as soon as they figured out what God said about it, stoned to death. Because it's again going to make us realize how amazingly good God is for his people. And that those who are recipients of it, but blaspheming God, saying evil things about this very good God, are just utterly inappropriate it is. And so we get to chapter 25, and this is all about the Sabbath. Plural. First singular and then plural. Okay, we're going to talk about the Sabbath. And that's just normally what we refer to that as the seventh day of the week, every Saturday, remember, in the Jewish religious system, in the Old Testament, in the Old Covenant. But here, actually, we're not talking so much about the seventh days, we're talking about the other Sabbaths, the big Sabbaths, the yearly Sabbath, and then the Sabbath of Sabbath years. And so we're getting to some interesting laws here, something we don't often think of when you think of God's goodness. Now, as we read this, just picture yourself at Mount Sinai, hearing this for the first time, and realizing you've never, ever experienced anything like this. You were a slave. You never rested. In fact, you know how the Exodus ended, right? There was even more work with even less privileges by the time they left Egypt. And now you're going to a new land, and you've gotten to know God at Mount Sinai, and now he's revealing what life in a new land will be like. And this should blow your mind, just how much rest there is in God's kingdom. You already know it, all the feasts, remember? You're forever resting and eating in God's kingdom. Well, now you get to these Sabbath year laws. So we start in verse 1. Yahweh spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land that I give you, the land shall keep a Sabbath to Yahweh. For 6 years you shall sow your field, and for 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather in its fruits. But on the seventh year there shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath to Yahweh. You shall not sow your field or prune your vineyard. You shall not reap what grows of itself in your harvest or gather the grapes of your undressed vine. It shall be a year of solemn rest for the land. The Sabbath of the land shall provide food for you, for yourself and for your male and female servants and for your hired servants and the sojourner who lives with you and for your cattle and for the wild animals that are in your land. All its yield shall be for food." This is an odd law. It starts, though, with introduction. When you come to the land that I give you, very much a future look at the land you're going to be in. It's not for now. It's for when you start the normal routine of work again. Okay, nothing's routine right now for the Israelites. God's literally providing food and water every day, miraculously. When you get back to the ordinary routine where you work for your food in the land, it's the land I shall give you. Make a note of that. It's important later. It's God's land given to them. Then you shall keep a Sabbath to Yahweh. But then you quickly find out the Sabbath isn't for you. The Sabbath is for the land. It's kind of an odd statement, and it focuses on that. On the seventh
year, every 7 years, for an entire year, the land is to rest. Don't prune anything. Don't plant anything. Don't harvest anything. Okay, there will be food for you that you can enjoy, but don't harvest those things that are in any case going to grow that year nonetheless, in spite of you not doing anything. Now, some people have looked at this and say, this makes perfect agricultural sense. It's a good agricultural law because the land needs to rest and things like that. And the only reason we don't do it is because we use things like artificial fertilizers and stuff. I already see the one guy who knows how plants work. This is not good for the land. Okay, it's like all the food laws. Some of it was good health laws, but that wasn't the purpose of the laws. The laws were God said so. Remember, we saw that repeatedly in the food laws. The feast laws. It's not because it was good for people to leave all their homes and gather at Jerusalem, all the males. That's not good for the land. That's when you get invaded, when all the people know. And God would miraculously take care of it. And so you look at this law and you're like, this does not make sense. This is not good for agriculture. It's bad for the seventh year, and it's probably really bad for the eighth year. And later we're going to find out there's even one time where the eighth year is also a rest year. So it's really, really bad for the ninth year. And yet you do it, and you don't sow, and you don't reap what grows of itself. It is, repeatedly here, a solemn rest for the land. Not an agricultural rest, not a good principled rest, a sacred rest, a solemn rest. This is a religious activity, not a farming activity. And yet, even though you can't plant, you can't prune to increase the yield, you can't do any of those things that you normally would do to optimize farming, and you're not allowed to reap what grows of itself, yet, verse 6, the Sabbath of the land shall provide food for you. That phrase alone explains everything. The rest of the land does not provide food for you. It is you working the land that provides food for you. This is an opposite to reality statement. When you don't do anything, that when you work for 6 years, that's how you get food. When you don't do anything on the seventh year, that's how you get food. You saw this already with some of the laws of collecting manna and stuff like that. You're not allowed to do it on the seventh day, so you do double on the sixth day. This isn't even double on the sixth year. This is the Sabbath year itself will provide food for you. A reminder to them that you may never, ever, ever enter God's land and think it's the work of your hand that provides for you. It's one of the first sermons Moses preaches to the next generation in Deuteronomy chapter 8. As one pastor summarizes so well, it's the sin of self-sufficiency that's being addressed there. And the Sabbath year, every 7 years, you would be reminded that it's not by my work that I eat. It is because of my God that I eat. This is obvious divine provision because it is contrary to normal provision. It's opposite to reason.
Well, that's the seventh year. Every 7 years. Sorry, question.
Because it says you're not allowed to reap what comes up by itself, but then it says the Sabbath of the land will provide food. So where does the food come from?
Yes, so where does the food come from? You're not allowed to reap. Remember verse 5, you shall not reap what grows of itself. You almost go back and see if the not is actually there. So it says you shall not reap what grows of itself in your harvest. Then it says the Sabbath will provide your food. Where does that food come from if you're not allowed to reap from your harvest? Well, we'll see where it comes from in a moment, but that's a great question. And for now, you answer it with, that's a good question. Okay, it's not revealed to us where that food comes from yet. Is it miraculous manna from the sky again? It's what kind of used to now at Mount Sinai. Is it the sixth year that we'll just have enough, a bit like the sixth day of the manna thing? Is it we can't reap from the harvest. So I can't take the grapes that in any case grew, but the things that were not part of my normal harvest that still grow, I can eat from that. And so God is just going to make random stuff grow. We don't know at this stage. It's not told us. So let's not answer it just yet. The question is, where on earth does the food come from? And you're like, well, the food apparently comes from the Sabbath of the land. The land not doing anything because of your involvement. And it's not just food for you, it's for yourself, it's your servants, slaves, it's your servants, it's the strangers passing through, it's your cattle even, okay, it's providing for your animals even the wild animals in the land. Everybody's going to be taken care of. All its yield shall be for food. There are things going to come up, that's your clue there, right? But there's going to be something, but it won't be part of your normal harvest selection. And so that kills a bit the temptation of a diligent farmer saying, you know, I'm not sure if I can trust God with that, so I'm gonna put extra fertilizer on the sixth year and hope that somehow has a... No, it's not that that's going to provide your food, not your normal harvest. Don't reap any of that. All right. Verse 8. You shall count 7 weeks of years. The scriptures, when it says 7 weeks, just think 7 sevens. Okay, a week is often a numeric term, actually, saying there's 7 of these things. So count 7 sevens of years. It's weeks of years. It defines the individual units, right? They're units of years. 7 times 7 years, very clearly there. So the time of the 7 weeks of years shall give you 49 years. Then you shall sound the loud trumpet on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement, which just came from that right earlier in Leviticus. You shall sound the trumpet throughout all your land, and you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you, when each of you shall return to his property, and each of you shall return to his clan. That 50th year shall be a jubilee for you. In it you shall neither sow nor reap what grows of itself, nor gather the grapes from the undressed vines. For it is a jubilee. It shall be holy to you. You may eat the produce of the field. In this year of jubilee, each of you shall return to his property. And if you make a sale to your neighbor or buy from your neighbor, you shall not wrong one another. You shall pay your neighbor according to the number of years after the jubilee, and he shall sell to you according to the number of years for crops. If the years are many, you shall increase the price, and if the years are few, you shall reduce the price, for it is the number of the crops that he is selling to you. You shall not wrong one another, but you shall fear your God, for I am Yahweh your God. Therefore you shall do my statutes and keep my rules and perform them, and then you will dwell in the land securely. The land will yield its fruit, and you will eat your fill and dwell in it securely. And if you say, what shall we eat in the 7th year if we may not sow or gather in our crop? I will command my blessings on you in the 6th year, so that it will produce a crop sufficient for 3 years. When you sow in the 8th year, you will be eating some of the old crop. You shall eat the old until the 9th year when its crop arrives. You know, this should just blow your mind. We'll do the maths just now. It's not so scary as what it sounds. But let's start at the beginning. It starts with the year of Jubilee. The year of Jubilee is an extra Sabbath year after 7 Sabbath years. And so you start counting when you get to the land, and then after 49 years, on that Day of Atonement, you do this loud trumpet thing, and you proclaim, it says, verse 10, proclaim liberty throughout all the land, among all the inhabitants. It gets explained a little bit later. But the point is, on that 50th year, when that year starts, you don't reset the counter of the 7-year Sabbath thing and say, okay, 7th year is done, 49th year is done, now we start working again. It's like, no, you take an extra year, okay, because it's a Sabbath of Sabbaths. The 50th year, verse 11, shall be a jubilee for you. It's an extraordinary celebration. You're proclaiming liberty, and you're treating it as kind of a double 7th year, double Sabbath year. Verse 12, for it is a jubilee, it shall be holy for you, you may eat the produce of the field. So here again you get that comment saying you're going to, the field will yield its food, but it's not under the normal conditions of a crop or a harvest. Okay, that's the first clue here. Again, a clue we've seen before in verse 7. Where the food actually comes from.
There's still stuff going to grow. It's just not going to be part of your normal harvest.
Later, we see some more gets added to it. And then it talks from verse 13 that in this year of Jubilee, there's more to this year than just the agricultural rest issue. In this year of Jubilee, each shall return to his property. And then it goes on to explain how the sale of property works in all the other years. Okay, this year, you go back to your property. And the basic concept is this. You get to a promised land with Moses, hopefully quite soon. It would be in a couple months after this. But then, remember, they disobeyed. So it became 40 years and it became much longer. But when you enter the promised land, be it now or in 40 years' time, as you come in, you're going to be allocated a piece of land. It's God's land. He's going to give it to you. And he's going to give you rules, saying this piece of land belongs to this tribe, and you guys divide it up this way. This piece of land goes to this tribe, and you guys divide. Every family gets a piece of land, except the Levites. Different story. Except the Levites. When you get that piece of land, you work it. And let's say it gets to a point where you can't work it for whatever reason. Or maybe you are working it, but you're not making ends meet. It's just not working. You can sell that piece of land to somebody else. You sell it to that person, and now here's the issue. On the year of Jubilee, the 50th year, every 50 years, so within every generation, you go back to the land that you sold, because you sold it and went somewhere else. The 50th year, everybody goes, it's like this grand reset. Everybody goes back to that original piece of land. And so the issue comes up, people saying, okay, but if I'm going to sell this land or buy this land from this poor guy, I can't make ends meet, or whatever reason they're selling. I don't want to pay a lot of money for that piece of land if it's year 48. I'm only going to get one crop of it, because year 49 I can't harvest it, and year 50 I have to give it back. And so the laws are given on how to adjust the price. It's super simple. It's not rocket science here. If you buy it on year one, after that 50 year, you start counting again, well, pay a lot of money. Why? Because you're going to get a lot of harvests from it. Okay, 50 years of harvest minus all the Sabbath years. But if you buy it on year 48, well, you adjust the price accordingly. And that's something normal agricultural sales is very familiar with, especially in this province where you've got crops like trees. Okay, by the time you sell your farm, you don't be like, quickly harvest all my trees. You can have another 10 years to go. Well, you calculate all that and you adjust the price accordingly. So there's nothing new to us. But the point here in all of this is verse 17 and 18. You shall not wrong one another, but you shall fear your God, for I am Yahweh your God. Therefore you shall do my statutes and keep my rules and perform them, and then you will dwell in the land securely. These two verses stand out in this chapter, partly because there's just a clear statement that doesn't match anything else. We were like little details of property prices. And suddenly we just get this broad sweeping statement. Remember, every single chapter or section that we looked at always had a purpose statement. Or a verse that just explains everything. Well, here's that verse. God is your God. Yahweh is your God. So at the end of the day, your motivation to determine the right price of the field in light of the coming year of Jubilee is simply based on don't do anything wrong to your neighbor. Don't go into the negotiation with, I'm going to get as much out of this as I can. The whole point of the year of Jubilee is you're not trying to get as much out of anything as you can in God's land. God provides. God blesses. All you're trying to do is just be faithful in your work. Your goal in life, here's the application for you and me, your goal in life is not to maximize everything for your benefit in life. Your goal in life is just to be faithful. God blesses that. Okay, yes, turn every dime over when you do your budget. But when it comes to generosity, make sure you're not accounting. Well, your accountant should account for it. But make sure you are not making sure you've optimized everything so you can get the maximum benefit out of what God has given you in life. That's contrary to God's law. Contrary to life under God's blessing. Okay, it's like if a child would fight with another child because he's got five sweets in his hand. And now they're fighting about how many sweets he can give out because he wants them all. And you as a dad are sitting there thinking, I've got a whole pack of sweets. What's this guy fighting about five sweets? Like if he gives six away, I'll give him 10. Okay, it's that concept here. Don't be that childish person who's going to wrong your neighbor, wrong one another, so that you get the best deal at all times. You're in God's kingdom. He's blessing you. You don't have to negotiate with such intensity. You just make sure you don't wrong your neighbor. And so you can imagine how this negotiation goes, right, between two faithful, God-fearing farmers in Israel. They get to, let's say we're in year 38. And now they want to sell a piece of land. And they come to negotiate with the elders of the city and they're standing at the city gate. The city they didn't build, they just took it over from the Canaanites by God's blessing. And the one is like, so I need to sell this, I need money, I can't make it work. And okay, it's year 38, how are we going to adjust the price? And the guy selling is like, look, you might want to pay a bit less, really, because I can't make it work. Maybe you can't. And the guy buying it is like, no, why don't I pay a bit more? Because the year of Jubilee is coming, and then you get it back, and at least you have a bit more money too then. Because God is blessing you, God is blessing me, we're all blessed. We're standing at city gate, with the elders making decisions. We didn't even build the city. Okay, it's that whole concept of making sure whatever we do here, we don't defraud another. You see how the world kind of is surprised at this when you have an accountant and he tells you how you can evade a bunch of tax and you tell him, no, I want to pay every bit of tax that I should. Okay, it's just like they can't comprehend that kind of concept. Well, it's an ordinary concept for us as believers, isn't it? All right, back to verse 10 though. It's to proclaim liberty. And we're going to get a lot of liberty that takes place in the year of Jubilee. The first one here is liberty of the land. Okay, the land goes back to everyone who had it originally when God divided up the land and said, it's my land, you may work here, you may work there, and you get it all back. So that's some of the liberty that's going to come. You have a year of extraordinary blessing for no work, contrary to no work. And on top of that, the main focus of the 50th year is liberty. Everybody, liberty. Everything just wonderful. It's free. God will make everything right again. There will be no bondage. If you sold a piece of land, you get it back. And we'll see even if you sold yourself, you will get it all back. Then just quickly, verse 21. Here is the source of provision in the 50th year. I will command my blessing on you in the sixth year, so that it will produce a crop sufficient for 3 years. Now, I don't think this is just talking about the 48th year, because that's the sixth year. Obviously, counting 49 would be the seventh year. I don't think it's just talking about the sixth year before the one that doubles up as the year of Jubilee. This might well be true for all the seventh year Sabbaths. What is your source of blessing on the Sabbath year, and then specifically the year of Jubilee added? God commands his blessing on you. Okay, you're entering year seven, and you're like, oh, I'm not sure we're going to make ends meet, and then next year is Jubilee year, so it's 2 years. I'm kind of stressing about this. God is sitting in heaven, he's like, hey, blessing, come here. On them. He's just going to command. It's going to be sovereign, providential, but sovereign blessing. Where's your fruit going to come from? Well, there's going to be the fruit will, the land will give a yield. We saw that in verse 7 and, verse 12. And here we see the sixth year is going to be three times as productive as normal. But remember, it's not the random things that grow or the sixth year that helps you store up enough for 3 years. It is God commanding his blessing on you. The reason your crop is so productive on the sixth year is not because you were nervous about the seventh year and added fertilizer. It is because God told the grapes, grow more, grow bigger. And so it's very simple. He explains the math in all the terms so you don't have to figure it out yourself. It will produce a crop sufficient for 3 years. When you sow in the eighth year, so the seventh year you're not sowing, in the eighth year you are sowing. So by the end of the eighth year, you can eat the 8 year's food. But by the end of the eighth year, you will still be eating some of the old crop. And so the eighth year, imagine this, sixth year, tremendous, triple blessing. Seventh year, no work, you're provided for. Eighth year, just a bonus. You don't even need it. Do you understand what life under God's care is like? I don't think we grasp it fully. The 2 years you would worry are the 2 years up front you are blessed, so you know you don't have to worry. And the 8 year when you can work again, the only motivation for work is because, well, work honors God. You don't have to work for food because you still have a third of the crop of the sixth year. Do you see the overt blessing? It's over the top. It doesn't make sense. But that is life. And covenant with God, and in this case, physical life in a kingdom where God is literally the king of the land. And so you've got the year of Jubilee, there's liberty for the land, as you see, it all returns back, and you are very well taken care of in God's kingdom. Do you understand now why it's really bad for somebody to come into the camp and blaspheme this God? Okay, it puts verse chapter 24 in perspective again. Well, the chapter continues. There's more. The land shall not be sold in perpetuity. That means forever. For the land is mine. For you are strangers and sojourners with me. And in all the country you possess, you shall allow a redemption of the land. If your brother becomes poor and sells part of his property, then his nearest redeemer shall come and redeem what his brother has sold. If a man has no one to redeem it, and then himself become prosperous and find sufficient means to redeem it, let him calculate the year since he sold it and pay back the balance to the man to whom he sold it and then return to his property. But if he has not sufficient means to recover it, then what he sold shall remain in the hand of the buyer until the year of Jubilee. In the Jubilee it shall be released and he shall return to his property. If a man sells a dwelling house in a walled city, he may redeem it within a year of its sale. For a full year he shall have the right of redemption. If it is not redeemed within a full year, then the house in the walled city shall belong in perpetuity to the buyer throughout his generations. It shall not be released in the year of the Jubilee. But the houses of the villages that have no wall around them shall be classified with the fields of the land. They may be redeemed, and they shall be released in the Jubilee. As for the cities of the Levites may redeem at any time the houses and the cities they possess. And if one of the Levites exercises his right of redemption, then the house that was sold in a city they possess shall be released in the Jubilee. For the houses and the cities of the Levites are their possession among the people of Israel. But the fields of pasture land belonging to their cities may not be sold, for that is their possession forever. Nothing new here, really. It's the year of Jubilee already explained. This now just goes through some nuances. So a house in a walled city is exempt from the Jubilee laws. A house in an unwalled city is just as though it was a piece of land. But if anything is the Levites, then the rules are a bit different. In their favor, every time. Again, remember, the Levites are the ones who are not allocated a piece of land in the promised land. They're scattered throughout the land. And so God provides for them in this extraordinary way. One thing, though, that stands out in this section, besides just the customizations of what we already know, is verse 23, the setup here. The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, so the Jubilee things come into play, for, here's the reason, the land is mine. You are strangers and sojourners with me. It's quite a statement. There's private land allocated to you. It comes back to you every 50 years. But you need to remember that you are actually not the landowners. I am the landowner. You guys aren't even citizens. You guys are like strangers that came here and I gave you a piece of land and you can work it. It's all mine. Now, we understand this concept. This is the concept not of socialism. This is the concept of a kingdom. Okay, our Zulus understand it. It's the king's land. It's all the king's land. You don't actually own the land. Oh, you can do all kinds of stuff on it, but it stays the king's land. And so for us to have an overly capitalistic mindset, you got to fix that. Okay, capitalism is not going to be the economy of the new heavens and the new earth. It's going to be a kingdom. A blessed kingdom. A kingdom where you don't have to own anything and you can buy stuff and God will grant you stuff and it will always come back to you and God will bless you in it. But it's all His land and He's in the entire control over it. And that is why, by the way, you working hard on your piece of land is not primarily for your sustenance, because the king will just take care of you too. You working hard on your piece of land is actually just to be a good steward of what the king has given you. Well, that has concepts in our mind of New Testament giving to the church, right? We're just stewards of what God has blessed us with. So make sure verse 23 is not socialism. It's a kingdom of blessing. Verse 35. If your brother becomes poor and cannot maintain himself with you. There's your definition of poverty, right? Not he has little. He cannot maintain himself. Okay, so he's destitute. He cannot maintain himself with you. He's not a lazy bum. He's somebody who just can't make ends meet no matter what he does. You shall support him as though he were a stranger and a sojourner, and he shall live with you. Take no interest from him or profit, but fear your God, that your brother may live beside you. You shall not lend him your money at interest, nor give him your food for profit. I am Yahweh your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. If your brother becomes poor beside you and sells himself to you, you shall not make him serve as a slave. He shall be with you as a hired servant and as a sojourner. He shall serve with you until the year of Jubilee. Then he shall go out from you, he and his children with him, and go back to his own clan and return to the possession of his fathers. For they are my slaves, whom I have brought out of the land of Egypt, that they should not be sold as slaves. You shall not rule over him ruthlessly, but shall fear your God. As for your male and female slaves, whom you may have, you may buy male and female slaves from among the nations that are around you. You may also buy from among the strangers who sojourn with you and their clans that are with you, who have been born in your land, and they may be your property. You may bequeath them to your sons after you to inherit as a possession forever. You may make slaves of them, but over your people, your brothers, the people of Israel, you shall not rule one over another ruthlessly. Again, you've got a couple of the clear explaining sentences, right? You shall fear your God. You saw that in verse 36 and verse 43. Then verse 38 was that grand purpose verse again. The verses just make sense of everything. I am Yahweh your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt and give you the land of Canaan, and I will be your God. Why do we have these laws about not making slaves of your fellow Israelites? Well, as we see later, you can't make a slave of somebody else's slave. And so they are my slaves, and I brought them out of slavery of Egypt. So they went from Egyptian slavery to slavery under God. The most blessed transition that ever happened to them, right? It's better to be a slave of a good master than it is to be a free man. And here you have a perfect master, and they're realizing just how different slavery in God's land is compared to slavery in Egypt. There was no rest, and here we're getting like rest all the time. Every year there's feast days, every 7 years, the whole year, every seventh year, there's an extra year of rest. It's amazing. And so don't make slaves of your own people. But you can have slaves from the nations around you for whatever reasons, be it military related, or just the nations around them have come and offered themselves as slaves because this nation is thriving. We'd rather be a slave in a thriving nation than be on our own. Who do those people belong to? Well, not to the Lord. They're strangers. They're outside the covenant. And so they can be your slaves. They're slaves to their gods. Their gods are nothing. You can make them your slaves. And you can hand them down as to future generations and things like that. We'll later find laws on slavery so that they are always masters to their slaves as God is to them. And so their slaves would always be in a better position, for the faithful at least, if they work for the faithful. But the point here is very simply, the land belongs to God, we saw that. You and one another belong to God. And so why do you have so much redemption? Why do you have so much liberty, especially in the year of Jubilee? Because you're slaves of a God of liberty. You're a slave of a God who commands his blessings upon you. Verse 49 ends with just a practical context for all these laws. It says, don't act ruthlessly. You may never be in a position of exploiting others, ever. Because you are used to being exploited, and now you're in a kingdom where you're not exploited, quite opposite, you are overly blessed. So you make sure you never deal ruthlessly with anyone. Continues with some more nuance of these laws, verse 47. If a stranger or sojourner with you becomes rich, and your brother beside him becomes poor and sells himself to the stranger or sojourner with you or to a member of the stranger's clan, then after he is sold, he may be redeemed. One of his brothers may redeem him, or his uncle, or his cousin may redeem him, or a close relative from his clan may redeem him. Or if he grows rich, he may redeem himself. He shall calculate with his buyer from the year when he sold himself to him until the year of Jubilee, and the price of his sale shall vary with the number of years. The time he has with his owner shall be rated as the time of a hired servant. If there are still many years left, he shall pay proportionately for his redemption some of his sale price. If there remains but a few years until the year of Jubilee, he shall calculate and pay for his redemption in proportion to his years of service. He shall treat him as a servant hired year by year. He shall not rule ruthlessly over him in your sight. And if he is not redeemed by these means, then he and his children with him shall be released in the year of Jubilee. For it is to me that the people of Israel are slaves. They are my servants, whom I have brought out of the land of Egypt. I am Yahweh your God. This is a significant nuance to the previous paragraph. The previous paragraph was, you, Mr. Israelite, live beside another Israelite, he's poor, and you have this transaction. Now it's a different story. The richer and more successful guy is not an Israelite. He's a stranger. He's a sojourner. He's got business here. He's growing wealthier. The Israelite next to him. So you're on this side. You see the rich man on the other side of the rich stranger. Another side is a poor Israelite. And these laws are given on how the nation of Israel will govern this rich stranger. And all the laws are there to make sure you don't exploit this rich stranger just because he is a stranger. You calculate the same fair price as you would otherwise have calculated. Now, granted, there's an edge to it, because the stranger is a stranger, and so you see that little edge to it in verse 53. He shall treat him as a servant hired year by year. He shall not rule ruthlessly over him in your sight. Okay? So it says, rich stranger needs to not deal ruthlessly with him in your sight. You are the one looking at this, making sure the rich man is treated, the rich stranger is treated just as fairly as it would be an Israelite. Everything's fair, but he is still accountable to God's law. Just because he is a stranger and makes sure he gets the law, makes sure he gets justice, does not mean he can do what he wants. Because the person whom he has taken as a hired servant doesn't belong to him. That person, that poor man, belongs to Yahweh. And as long as this stranger, presumably even unbeliever, is in God's land, he obeys God's rules. And so, like it or not, doesn't matter what his culture says about it, in the year of Jubilee, that man is a free man. So there's a bit of an edge to it. These laws are there to protect him, that he gets treated the same as though it were as a fellow Israelite. Perfect justice. No exploiting the stranger. And yet, the stranger is still submissive, has to submit to the law of God. And it's the other neighbor, this third-party neighbor, in whose sight he has to make sure this happens justly. And so put yourself in this third-party's chair, seat, shoes, whatever. You have nothing to do with any of this. That's between poor Israelite and rich stranger. That's nothing to do with you. But the rich stranger doesn't believe God and isn't going to submit to God's law automatically himself. The poor man, well, it's hard for him to insist on justice according to God's law because he's the one kind of in a disadvantaged position. And so it's your responsibility, third party, who has nothing to do with anything, to make sure that there's no exploitation happening for the rich stranger and that the rich stranger still submits to the law of the land, God's law. This is the opposite of dealing ruthlessly. It's you assuming responsibility on behalf of another that has no benefit or implications for you whatsoever. And making sure that if something goes wrong here, you are the one that reports it to the court and the city gates and makes sure justice happens for the rich man or for the poor man, whichever way the ruthless behavior is going. And so, when it says in verse 10, it's the year of proclaiming liberty, and it ends repeatedly somewhat with the word ruthlessly, you can picture the year of Jubilee as a year of liberty from exploitation. A year of liberty from Egypt-like. A year where everything goes back to the way God gave it to you 50 years ago. To make sure there's perfect equity in the land. And that is the year of Jubilee. And to just throw chapter 24 in it again, that odd story that just kind of jumped in from out of nowhere. How bad would it be for the son of that rich stranger living under these conditions in a promised land to go out in the middle of the city and yell blasphemous things at the God who's ruling over them? Wouldn't that be inappropriate? Well, that was the story of chapter 24, right? The son of an Egyptian married to an Israelite woman who went out in God's land under all these beautiful conditions and said something blasphemous. And he got stoned for justice for his own sin, and everybody remember laid their hands on it. We had a bit of a chat about that afterwards, to make sure that everyone who heard that blasphemous statement is not going to be guilty of blasphemy. Okay, how can you hear something like that? That's offensive. Well, that one who committed the sin takes all the blame of anything wrong said about God in God's economy. Our God is gracious. Beware of the sin of self-sufficiency. Praise the Lord for his many blessings. We're not under the Mosaic covenant. We're not in a promised land. God is not a direct king over us in that sense. But, well, he's still a king over us, isn't he? Our Lord Jesus is our king. He is the one providing for us providentially through really bad legal laws, unlike the perfect ones he had. And so trust God. Don't overexploit every situation for your benefit. God will bless those who are faithful to him. And recognize that your success in life is because of his blessing on what you do, not merely because of what you did. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for new life in Jesus Christ. And Father, we can get a glimpse here, a very clear glimpse, of what life in your kingdom for all eternity is going to be like. Oh Lord, we wouldn't even recognize it as anything similar to this life. It will be so different, even though it will still be earthly life, a new earth's life. But it will still be ordinary work and faithfulness to you. But there will be no ruthless behavior. There will be no exploitation. There will be overt liberty and overt blessing on everything that we do. Because at the end of the day, it is not us who labor who produce our success, but it is us who are faithful to you, and you choose to bless whom you choose to bless, and you always take care of us. Oh Father, in this world we will have tribulation, and the righteous will often do great righteousness and suffer because of it, and a wicked man will do great wickedness and succeed because of it. But Father, that is only because this life is affected by the curse. It doesn't change who you are. It doesn't change how you take care of us. So we trust you and help us to trust you day by day for Jesus' sake.